Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about the Gnostic Gospels. Now, this subject has some currency because a best-selling book, we've talked about it many times here on Issues Etc., The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, has under its fiction, well, another fiction. Dan Brown was not the first to spin fiction about who Jesus is and what he's about, and it doesn't only go back to the likes of Elaine Pagels, who has made so much of the Gnostic Gospels. The fiction goes back to the Gnostics themselves and the Gospels they penned. We're going to be talking about the real history of the Gnostic Gospels, as opposed to what's put forth and popularized by Dan Brown's best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code. Dr. Ben Witherington is our guest. He's professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary. He's author of several books, including The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. Dr. Witherington has also written the cover story for the latest issue of Christianity Today magazine titled, Why the Lost Gospels Lost Out. Dr. Witherington, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you.
Give us a brief history of the formation of what we call the New Testament and the competing claims that were often also put down on paper, papyrus, or however they were written out, of this heretical sect within Christianity and other religions called the Gnostics.
Well, the canon was formed in essence over the first couple of centuries A.D., and then it was formally limited in the 4th century A.D. There was a collection of Gospels that was already in circulation. The four canonical Gospels circulated together, probably by as early as 125 A.D., and there was a collection of Paul's letters that circulated together in the 2nd century as well. There was a lot of debate about some of the other documents, James, Jude, 1st and 2nd Peter, Hebrews, because it had no author, those kinds of things. But if we're talking about the majority of the New Testament, already Christian groups were looking to the canonical Gospels and Paul's letters as the authoritative apostolic tradition in the 2nd century A.D., and that was the basis of evaluating the rise of the Gnostic movement in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century A.D. as aberrant from day one. There was already a sort of standard. The word canon means a measuring rod. And so there was already apostolic tradition by which this material known as the Gnostic material could be evaluated and found wanting. There were a lot of traits of this literature that made it very unlike what we find in the canon of the New Testament itself. Not the least of which was it was profoundly anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish in various ways, and it also really lacked a positive doctrine of creation. It saw matter is evil and spirit is good. And the reason they were called Gnostics, the Greek word gnosis, means knowledge. And the essence of their claim was that salvation was for those in the know. It was for the elite and the effete. And if you had this insider trader knowledge, then in essence you could save yourself by obtaining this knowledge. So it was an early version of a self-help program, in a sense. And, of course, that was diametrically opposed to what the canonical Gospels claimed and what Paul's letters claimed, which was that salvation was something that was a radical rescue mission by someone outside of ourselves who came and redeemed us. We'd fallen and we couldn't get up, and no amount of information was going to produce transformation. And so the theology of God, of the goodness of creation, the theology of salvation, the theology and doctrine of election, a whole host of interrelated, the nexus of those theological issues, was twisted and turned in a variety of different ways in the Gnostic literature, which was not really Christian.
Dan Brown and others, of course, upon whom he has based his fiction, The Da Vinci Code, make a very different claim. They claim that while some of the New Testament documents might have been written early on, they were in a very different form than they eventually emerge at the Council of Nicaea, that it, rather than a New Testament canon being at least in essence there by which, in existence already, by which the Gnostic Gospels could be judged to be true or false, as you have said, Dan Brown says, no, it's kind of the other way around. This New Testament was there in a very skeletal form, but these Gnostic Gospels held sway until the Council of Nicaea, when they were put away and discredited, and this kind of skeletal New Testament was beefed up and elaborated upon to establish Christianity as it had never been before, with Jesus as the Son of God and the Savior of the world.
Right.
Does that have any historical veracity to
it? Let's just deal with the Gnostic documents for a minute. The only document that is sometimes called Gnostic that any scholars of merit that I know of think might have come from the end of the first century or early in the second century is the Gospel of Thomas. All of the other Gnostic documents, and especially the ones that Dan Brown's interested in, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, etc., are clearly, transparently documents that did not exist before the end of the 2nd century or 3rd or 4th centuries A.D. Our history of knowledge about the Gnostic movement comes from our knowledge of people like Valentinius and others who arose in the middle of the 2nd century A.D., spawned a movement which was an offshoot of Christianity, much as, for example, Mormonism has been or Jehovah's Witness has been in the last 200 years, and went its own way. So we really, in the first place, we have plenty of evidence that the Gospels and Paul's letters already existed in the 2nd century A.D., essentially in the form that we know them today. For example, we have a papyrus, P45, that has a portion of the Gospel of John, probably the latest of the four Gospels to be written. This dates to 125 A.D. It's a portion of John 18. Anybody who's really studied the textual history of the New Testament knows that we have witnesses of, really, in essence, all of the canonical documents by the 4th century A.D., and in fact, most of them by the 3rd century A.D., and some of them by the 2nd century A.D. And the most important thing to say about that is that our earliest and best witnesses attest to us a Jesus that is both divine and human. This is not an idea that was imposed on the church or on the canon, for that matter, by revisionist history rewriting in the 4th century A.D. All the Council of Nicaea did was to debate what was the precise relationship between the Father and the Son, not whether either one of them were divine. The issue was whether Christ shared the very same divine substance with the Father, or he had like or similar divine substance as the Father.
Now, just to pause for a moment, Dan Brown says, to make the distinction clear here, that Nicaea was about whether Jesus was merely a human or a divine being.
Which is absolutely false. I mean, that's a total misrepresentation of the Council of Nicaea. So, I mean, the thing that disturbs me most about Dan Brown is not that he's an amateur and he's way over his head and way out of his depth in dealing with this material. The thing that bothers me the most about it is that he begins his novel with a statement that says fact, which claims that all the statements about documents in this book are accurate. So he's, in essence, making a claim that he's writing a novel like a Michener novel, well-researched, thorough study of the historical substance, but the central characters are fictitious and the central plot is fictitious. Well, he presents his novels, as he does with Angels and Demons, as if it was historical fiction. Well, what it is pretty much pure fiction, especially in regard to the religious and historical claims he makes in the novels. And that's really disturbing. So the real question becomes, in regard to him, is he willfully ignorant, or is he, in fact, willfully presenting disinformation, knowing better? There are some real disturbing issues that his novels raise.
Dan Brown has said lately in the press, I've heard him on several occasions say, and it's kind of become a mantra of his of late, the only thing fictional about my novel are the characters.
Yeah.
Everything else is true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That you express your frustration, that has got to be monumentally frustrating to someone who knows the history of these things.
It is, and even more frustrating is if you go to his website and look at the list of so-called scholars that he's relying on to base his information on. I mean, there's only one nationally recognized biblical scholar in the whole lot of them that he lists. Most of those people, I've been in biblical studies for 30 years now, I've never even heard of them. And so, you know, he's obviously dealing with secondary sources and people who have their hair on fire about Gnosticism, but frankly are not experts in their field. And so, you know, I think that that's part of the problematic nature of it. But here's the deal. We live in a Jesus-haunted culture that is biblically illiterate for the most part. Now, when you put those two things together, you have a recipe for disaster. Almost any claim about Jesus can be made, and if the power of your rhetoric is good enough, you can make it stick, because people don't know any better. People don't know the Bible well enough or the history of the Bible well enough to refute such stuff. And so we're living in a volatile and really dangerous situation in our culture with massive biblical illiteracy. Some people will sense that there's something wrong here, but they won't know what it is. That's the experience I've had with going to a lot of churches all over the country in regard to this matter. In the past 6 months, I've done a lot of Da Vinci Code events. And people have this strong sense that when they get to page 131 and read 131 through 145 in the Da Vinci Code, something's badly wrong here, but they can't articulate what it is. Or it makes them curious and they raise the question, well, has the church been snookering us all this time? Maybe this really is true. Americans like titillation. They like conspiracy theories. They like to suspect Big Brother or large organizations as being trying to dupe other people. That's characteristic of the American character in various ways. And that plays right into Dan's novel plays right into all of that.
We're talking with Dr. Ben Witherington, professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary. He's author of several books, including The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. Dr. Witherington has also written the cover story for the latest issue of Christianity Today magazine titled Why the Lost Gospels Lost Out. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. I remember during my seminary days, and I believe this is probably postgraduate after the seminary work, when in a graduate course we were studying the Nag Hammadi library.
Mm-hmm.
These intertestamental pseudepigrapha is what we were talking about, false writings that were very interesting, intriguing, a lot of it kind of apocalyptic, some of it pretending to be Old Testament, some pretending to be New Testament, some pretending to be lost knowledge from between the Testaments. And I remember the professor making it very clear, he was trying to make the case for why this was eventually deemed to be inauthentic, but not only inauthentic, but uncanonical.
Uh-huh.
He says it has to do with what the church always exercised when it came to looking at Scripture, the regula fide, the analogy of faith. Does this speak with one voice with regard to the person of Christ, with regard to his redeeming work? Does it give credence to the Old Testament Scriptures as speaking of Christ? This was the basic rule of thumb that the church exercised when it looked at any claimed divine writing. Tell us about that.
Well, I would want to talk more broadly about the apostolic tradition. I think that there were parameters beyond which early Christianity knew pretty clear what was beyond the pale. And the apostolic tradition had some variety to it. We have four Gospels that present Jesus from four different angles. So there was diversity, but there was also unity. And the unity is what really defined the outer parameters of how far diversity could go in those matters. Now, as for the analogia fide, I don't really think, if we're talking about the Reformation idea, that there's a sort of red thread or theme that goes throughout the Bible that's the sort of litmus test of whether something's true or not. I think that's a Reformation idea, which, in fact, you can't really find in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century church. But what you do find is this clear understanding that if a tradition is not grounded in the original historical apostolic teaching, and before that in the teaching of Jesus, then forget it. It's not authoritative. It doesn't speak with the voice of the apostolic tradition and the original folks who created the New Testament document, and therefore so much the worse for them.
Well, and at least from conversations with other guests on this subject, that apostolic authority was not some tenuous or wispy thing. At least in the early days of the early church, it was a tangible thing. You talked about men who had sat at the feet of the apostles,
right?
And who could say, "Yeah, this is what he said. This I heard him preach. That's what he preached."
Right.
What I'm reading here squares with what he preached.
Exactly. Luke, in his preface to his two-volume work, Luke Acts, says that he's consulted the eyewitnesses and the earliest preachers of the word. Well, that's exactly what we're dealing with here. If the document's not actually written by an apostle, then it's a passing on of apostolic tradition from those who had learned from the apostles. And that's the most crucial thing, is that there's an unbroken apostolic tradition from Easter on, and the material was passed on. Paul frequently uses this kind of language of that which I have received, I have passed on, in regard to the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15. It's the language of the passing on of sacred traditions. Already, the Christian traditions were seen as sacred traditions that needed to be preserved and passed on in a way analogous to the way the Hebrew Scriptures had been passed on and preserved. And so, I think the canonizing process is already set in motion. 2 Timothy 3:16 tells us that the early church took very seriously that the Hebrew Scriptures were the Word of God. It's God-breathed and profitable for reproof and teaching. And see, that's one of the things that is most problematic for Gnosticism, because Gnosticism breaks out in a rash when it comes to the Old Testament. They don't want a God that's a God of history. They don't want a God who's a God of creation. Salvation doesn't have to do with history and historical events and the notion that creation is good and that evil is something moral and not merely something physical. Gnosticism really broke out in a rash when it came to any kind of Jewish theology whatsoever. And one of the things that characterizes Gnostic documents is almost no recognition of, quotation of, or use of the Old Testament or Old Testament ideas. Now, that is absolutely different from the documents that are canonized in our New Testament canon, which are repeatedly dependent on the Old Testament in numerous ways, and believe that the whole thing about salvation has to do with a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies and promises and the like.
Didn't even some of the Gnostics, the early Christian Gnostics, not only deny the Old Testament, but also say that the God portrayed in the Old Testament was not God himself, but an emanation, an evil more in the created realm, given that dualistic nature mm-hmm. between spiritual and material, a God more of the created realm than of the pure spirit realm?
Well, yes. The God of the Old Testament was called a demiurge, which was some kind of created being that's semi-divine or something. It's supernatural. It's like an angel or demon or something. But it's not the big God that's over it all. the big God can't have anything to do with matter because matter is evil and tainted, and spirit is the only thing that's good. So, you know, there are these eons or emanations from God that sort of provide a buffer zone between God and the created universe, which is wicked and fallen. So, yes, you're absolutely right about that. The God of the Old Testament is viewed as a sort of lesser deity.
Before we go on in our conversation, as we approach this break here, Dr. Witherington, let's set some dates just for kind of frame of reference for our listeners as to when a testimony or a publishing of a catalog or a list, complete or near complete, of the New Testament canon can be found in history, recorded by Christians.
Okay.
With about 2 minutes here.
Well, the simple thing to say is that we have a testimony both in the East with Athanasius and in the West with the Pope about 367 A.D., that it's these 27 books and no others. Now, what's interesting about that, and again, it goes against what Dan Brown is suggesting, is that the canon was not officially closed in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. There was still debate about the New Testament canon on until the latter part of that 4th century A.D. 367 is the date when we have the strong statement from Bishop Athanasius and then from the Pope. Yes, it's these 27 books and no others. However, there is also the Muratorian canon list, which some scholars think is from the 3rd century, which would be only one century earlier than the two statements I just made. But some think it comes from the end of the 2nd century A.D. And the Muratorian canon list has most of the 27 books of the New Testament listed as authoritative books for the Christian Church. What prompted our getting our act together was actually heresy. It was Marcion, one of the earliest 2nd century heretics, who himself wanted to limit the Bible to Luke and a few letters of Paul, throw out the whole Old Testament, and throw out most of the rest of the other books we call the New Testament. And there was a clear reaction of the Orthodox Church around the empire to Marcion's truncated kind of canon list. And that's probably what historically most prompted the Muratorian canon list and other canon lists that were to come after that.
We're talking with Dr. Ben Witherington about the Gnostic Gospels. When we come back, we're going to talk about the traits of the Gnostic literature in a little more depth. What is it they portray about, what kind of Jesus do they portray, about man's predicament, about the nature of salvation that raised red flags for the early church, and eventually, quite contrary to what Dan Brown is teaching in the Da Vinci Code, were not thrown out because they were genuine Christianity in favor of something new and made up, but they were thrown out because they were pretenders and counterfeits to the Christian faith. We'll be talking about that after the break. Feel free to join us. The best callers will receive Dr. Witherington's book. It's called The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We will be taking your phone calls on the other side of this break, and this break is a good time to call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you ever finished reading a Bible book, but then felt frustrated because several of your questions went unanswered? Well, you'll find a helpful resource when studying the Old Testament book of Leviticus with a new Concordia commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June. You can find out more about this commentary under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia commentary on Leviticus costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. How does each chapter of Leviticus find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ? And what was the purpose of the detailed instructions in the so-called divine speeches of Leviticus? Find out with a Concordia commentary on Leviticus by Dr. John Kleinig. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for June, the Concordia commentary on Leviticus.
Creation in schools. How do we teach it?
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the children's book, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs.
Well, Ken, many Christian teachers in public school systems look on themselves as missionaries in what you could call a pagan system. Now, how can they effectively teach creation?
You know, it's very difficult for Christian teachers. In America, the humanists have been successful in virtually outlawing the Bible and its teachings. But as a former public school teacher myself, I believe that Christian teachers can effectively teach against evolution without even mentioning the Bible or creation. They can simply teach students how to think. You see, I found that most science classes only instruct the students in what to think, not how to think. When you teach students the right way to think, they'll easily see that evolution isn't science, but just a belief. I made sure my students understood what science is, but also what it isn't. I taught them that real science involved using your five senses in the present to build computers, space shuttles, and so on. But when you come to Origins, you've just stepped outside of this sort of science. You're now dealing with the beliefs of scientists who weren't there. I found the students quickly caught on and then asked questions like, well, how can we know where we came from? Well, what a great opening to give them the answer. God created.
What should we think, then, about dinosaurs? Can the Bible shed any light? Ken Ham's answer is yes, and we invite you to read his free booklet on dinosaurs when you log on to our website, AnswersRadio.com, AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. A person who is print literate can understand messages that are conveyed through words on a printed page. But in our society today, messages are also sent through media such as TV and movies. Some of these messages reinforce our Christian faith and morals, but many do not. Therefore, it is important that our children learn to be media literate as well as print literate. When a TV show begins to encourage a non-Christian lifestyle, you may want to change the channel. But in some cases, it might be better to discuss the program with your children. Explain to them that in Christ, we have been given a better way of living. A child who is media literate recognizes immorality in the media when he sees it. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk about the book of Leviticus with Dr. Andrew Steinman of Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. And Sunday night on the program, Christ-Centered Fatherhood with Pastor David Shaddy of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Indianapolis. That's from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, if you'd like to post a question or a comment in advance of Sunday's conversation with Pastor Shaddy on Christ-Centered Fatherhood, feel free to do so at our Issues Etc. forum. It's at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. The forum is there. Post your question or your comment on Christ-Centered Fatherhood in advance of Sunday night's program or that evening during the program. And as time permits, we'll get to your question or your comment in that conversation from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. We're talking about the Gnostic Gospels. Dr. Ben Witherington is our guest, professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary, author of several books, including The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. He has also written the cover story for the latest issue of Christianity Today magazine, titled Why the Lost Gospels Lost Out. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Dr. Witherington, let's talk about the traits of the Gnostic literature. Dan Brown says it was kind of the original stuff. The canonical stuff we have today was all embellished and added to. What were the traits that the early church saw in the Gnostic Gospels, the other Gnostic literature, that signaled them that there was something wrong here, that it did not fit? In particular, what kind of a Jesus is presented in the Gnostic Gospels?
Well, if you read most of the Gnostic material, one of the things that's characteristic of it is that it is syncretistic, and what I mean by that is it amalgamates a variety of sources of kinds of material. For example, it integrates Platonic and other kinds of Greek speculation about the heavens, the eons, the character of divine beings, all that sort of stuff, with biblical ideas. And it doesn't even flinch when it does that. It thinks that that's perfectly okay. Much of the Gnostic literature, especially the parts that Dan Brown is interested in, such as the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and the Gospel of Philip, are actually trying to fill in the gaps where our canonical Gospels don't speak. And this is true of much of New Testament apocryphal documents, the documents written in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century. You know, it's the sort of Paul Harvey, well, now you know the rest of the story deal. Isn't this a surprise? In the case of the Gnostic Gospels, mainly what they are focusing on is what they claim the risen Jesus said to his disciples during the 40 days between his resurrection and his ascension. So, in essence, they're dealing largely with material that supposedly involved private conversations with Mary Magdalene, with Philip, with Thomas, with this person, with that person, after Jesus rose from the dead. Now, you know, our canonical Gospels are remarkably circumspect about what they tell us that Jesus actually said after he rose from the dead. If you read John 20 or Luke 24 or the end of Matthew, Matthew 28, there are some things that Jesus says, but he's not giving us great long discourses. It's brief remarks, to say the least. And so this sort of opened the door, in the case of Gnostic speculators, for dreaming up all kinds of stuff that they thought Jesus ought to have said to various people. One of the real conundrums that I find most puzzling about Dan Brown is that the Gnostics were flaming anti-feminists, and yet Dan Brown wants to combine early Gnosticism with early pagan feminism, as if the Gnostics were wide open to the role of women in a way that early Christianity was not. Well, this is another piece of historical nonsense. The Gnostics were ascetic. They couldn't possibly have... They're rolling over in their graves over the idea that Gnostic theology would have supported the idea that Jesus married Mary Magdalene. To the contrary, they were ascetical. They believed in celibacy, abstention from material, physical, or intercourse kind of contact. And so he's presented us with a mishmash of ideas, some pagan, some Greek philosophical thought, some truly Gnostic. But he has a good precedent for that. I mean, Gnostic material is an amalgamation and mishmash of all kinds of non-biblical ideas with some biblical ideas.
So do documents such as, say, the Gospel of Philip even say what Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, claims they say about Mary Magdalene or about the role of women?
No, they none of them specifically say that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. What the Gospel of Philip and Mary imply is that there was a close relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene in regard to him passing on some sacred knowledge to her. She's called a koinonos of Jesus. Now, that word simply means companion. It doesn't mean spouse. The disciples are also called companions of Jesus. It doesn't mean that they were married to Jesus. So, and the worst part about all this is that the most important little piece that this whole speculation is based on, the original document has got literally holes in it. So there are gaps in the manuscript. At one point it says that Jesus kissed somebody on something, but the somebody in the something is missing from the text. You have to speculate what fills in the gaps. So it's extremely flimsy evidence. It's extremely flimsy. And in any case, This is all material that's part of Gnostic speculation from the late 2nd, early 3rd, 4th centuries A.D. It doesn't have any pedigree of historical authenticity to it.
Let's talk about the manuscripts as well when it comes to the New Testament. I have in front of me my Greek New Testament. There's an entire, in some cases, half or even more than half the page in the lower part of the page. The text is up on the other part. Critical apparatus is at the bottom, chronicling the variations in the manuscripts that we have, both extant and in fragments and things like that. There is a lot of difference there. What are we to make of the differences that are found in all of the many, many? We're talking about unbelievable numbers of manuscripts for each one of the books of the New Testament. What do we make of all these little differences?
Well, first of all, you don't freak out. As Bruce Metzger, the real doyen of textual criticism, says, we have better evidence for the New Testament than for any other comparable document from antiquity, whether we're thinking of Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars or Homer's Odyssey or you name it. We have over 4,500 part or whole manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, and most of those have been discovered in the last 150 years. So here's what I'm prepared to say. We're closer to the original text of the Greek New Testament today than at any point in church history since about the 2nd or 3rd century A.D. By the providence of God, we're a lot closer now to the original text than, say, the medieval church was. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, to say the least. So that's point number one. The second thing is, yes, there are a lot of minor variants, and there are a few major textual issues, too. For example, the story of the woman caught in adultery. There is a very serious debate as to whether that was an original part of the Gospel of John or not. Or Mark 16, 9 through 20-something. There's also a very serious debate amongst textual scholars as to whether that was an original part of the Gospel of Mark. Now, those are the only two large portions of the Greek New Testament about which there is serious debate as to whether they were original parts of the original inspired document. There are other minor parts, sentence here, sentence there, verb here, noun there. But as Bruce Metzger says, we have established with reasonable certainty about 90% of what the Greek New Testament originally said and looked like. And as for the other 10%, the other 10% does not raise any theological issues that would change anything major if we are wrong about what we think the earliest form of the tradition was. So most of the minor differences in all these manuscripts are stylistic improvements, grammatical improvements, spelling improvements, those kinds of things, minutiae. Most of them are not dealing with significant theological or ethical or eschatological issues at all. So, I mean, I'm happy to tell my students regularly that there is no significant theological issue that is really up for debate on the basis of text criticism. And that's, of course, another thing that's wrong with Dan Brown's novel, because what he suggests is that there was this massive cover-up or an imposition of the divinity of Christ on the New Testament sometime in the 4th century A.D. around the time of the Council of Nicaea. Now, to that I would say, rubbish. That's absolutely not true. Our earliest New Testament documents are Paul's letters, and the divinity of Christ, as well as his humanity, is very clearly revealed in various of Paul's letters, even if you don't want to start with the Gospels, because they were written later than Paul's letters in all likelihood. Even so, we have an extremely early testimony to the divinity of Christ. We even have, at the end of 1 Corinthians 16, an Aramaic prayer, Maranatha, which we have barbarized as Maranatha. But what Maranatha means is, come, O Lord. Now, here is a Jewish Christian praying in his mother tongue of Aramaic, praying for Jesus to come back, praying to Jesus for Jesus to come back. Early Jews did not pray to anybody but God. What does this tell us? It tells us that the very earliest followers of Jesus after Easter believed that he was the risen Lord, and they were already prepared to pray to him once he had gone to heaven. Now, that's an implicit claim to the divinity of Christ from day one, from Easter on. The earliest Christian confession was, Jesus is the risen Lord. We find it all over Paul's letters, the book of Acts. We could just sort of mow them down, but the evidence is very clear. So the idea that royal and divine robes were later put on Jesus, who was simply a really exalted and interesting human being, is historically false.
Folks, if you've read the Da Vinci Code and been either confused or intrigued by what you read, I'd like to hear from you. Don't be afraid or ashamed to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Or if you have a question on a comment or a comment on the reliability of the New Testament documents, call now 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers will receive Dr. Ben Witherington's book, The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of Dan Brown's sources is Elaine Pagels, and she has in her most recent book, I think it's called Beyond Belief.
Yes.
She has made the claim, in fact, we recently did a bit of an analysis of an interview that she did. She's made the claim with regard to the Gospel of John. Maybe I'm overstating her claim here, but it seems as though she's saying, first came the Gospel of Thomas, the Gnostic Gospel.
Right.
Then John was written to respond to it.
Right.
To kind of make this case for this divine Jesus.
Right.
How do you analyze this claim?
Well, let's look at what most scholars who have analyzed the Gospel of Thomas say. If you read the dictionary articles in the Anchor Bible Dictionary or the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, standard reference works, okay? Some of them not evangelical, some of them are. But it doesn't really matter which ones you read. Read any of them. Interpreters, Bible, dictionary, etc. But when you read them, one of the things that stands out is that whoever wrote the Gospel of Thomas, which I think was surely written in the 2nd century A.D., not only knows all the canonical Gospels, he also knows various of Paul's letters, he knows the letter of Hebrews, and he knows the editorial work, not just the source material found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, but the editorial work added to that source material by the four evangelists themselves. Now, the question you have to ask is, where in the world could the author of the Gospel of Thomas have been to have access to all four canonical Gospels, the letters of Paul, Hebrews, and various other New Testament documents? Well, the answer is, he couldn't have been anywhere in the 1st century A.D. He had to be in the 2nd century A.D. That's what we can say with some assurance. Other 1st century Christian documents, like the Didache, or the Epistle of Barnabas, or 1st Clement, know a few of these documents. For example, the Didache seems to be familiar with the Gospel of Matthew. Or 1st Clement knows Paul's letter to the Corinthians and writes his own letter to the Corinthians based on 1 Corinthians. But what none of these first century Christian authors have knowledge of is the wide scope of New Testament literature. And that's because New Testament documents were written all over the Roman Empire to various people at various times in various places, and it was only begun to be collected towards the end of the first century A.D. The Gospel of Thomas had to be written after a time which, when the majority of the corpus of the New Testament was already collected and was accessible to this author, because this material reflects that. Now, that's what the articles in the peer-reviewed dictionaries on the New Testament will tell you about this. Elaine Pagels is floating a new, creative, and interesting idea, which frankly doesn't have a lot of historical merit to it at all. And in any case, the portrayal of the divinity of Jesus in the Gospel of John, it's not like the Gospel of John is the first place in the canon that Jesus is portrayed as both God and human. That's nonsense. This is already the case in Paul's earliest letters. So well before the writing of the Gospel of John, we've got this anyhow. So in effect, it doesn't make any sense to argue that the Gospel of John and the divine portrayal of Jesus is a reaction to the Gospel of Thomas, which was already written. On the contrary, it's just a further development of the tradition of both the divine and human Jesus, which we find in the earlier New Testament documents. It's not a reaction to anything.
No, Elaine Pagels is not an unintelligent woman.
No, she's brilliant.
And certainly she is well aware of the mainstream of scholarship with regard to the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John.
Right.
Now, you're right. It's a novel idea. It's interesting. It's a theory. But how honest is this claim that she's making here, given the fact that she knows that the existence of Thomas is evidence in favor of the preexistence of the canonical Gospels rather than against the preexistence of the canonical Gospels?
Well, I don't question her honesty at all. I think she's a person of integrity, and I think she struggled long and hard to come to the conclusion she has. So I don't really question that at all. The issue is not honesty. The issue is critical judgment. Okay? And, you know, two scholars, equally bright and equally honest, can come to radically different conclusions about such historical matters. This happens regularly. It just happens that she is a distinctly minority voice that carries weight out of all proportion to the number of people who would actually agree with her opinion. And, you know, I'm happy for these kind of challenges. I think the discussion should be free and open and subject to critical scrutiny of all kinds. I'm fine with that. So I don't question her honesty or her integrity as a scholar. I just question her judgment.
Let's see if we can wrap this up here and try and lay out what we have done so far with regard to the claims of Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code and the documents upon which he's based his fiction. When he says that we have a period of time between 1 A.D. and 325 thereabouts, wherein the church was still thinking about who Jesus is, but coming to the conclusion, just a man. But somehow, by the time we get to 325, political and religious forces conspire to put that viewpoint down and rewrite, really revise the documents in order to make Jesus both human and divine. Can you read the bold-faced history that we have and the documents that we have to come to that conclusion?
No, I don't think you can. And it's not just a question of reading the New Testament. It's a question of reading the early church fathers, whether it's Irenaeus or Tertullian or Hippolytus, Justin Martyr, Polycarp. We could just mow them right on down, second-century figures into the third century. No, you simply can't possibly come to that kind of conclusion if you not only know the period, the history of the New Testament period, but the history from 100 A.D. to 325. It's not really a viable, possible historical conclusion.
If that is a bogus conclusion, then what becomes of Dan Brown's further claim that beyond 325 A.D. there is a vast conspiracy? The conspiracy itself kept secret to suppress the original nature of Christianity and to put forth a bogus idea of who Christ is and to perpetrate it on everyone who would come under the pale of the church.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody likes a good conspiracy theory, but the truth of the matter is that the Gnostic Gospels were never entertained as possible canonical documents. So it's not like they were originally in, and then later these gnarly people like Emperor Constantine excluded them. That's historically false. They were never in. They were never considered part of the apostolic tradition. There's just no evidence that they were. They were out there. And here's what you can say about that. The 2nd, the 3rd, and 4th century A.D., there was a lot of reading of a lot of different documents, some of which ended up in the canon, some of which didn't, some of which didn't end up in the canon are not heretical, like the Epistle of Barnabas, for example, or like the Didache, for example. And that's fine. Just because they didn't make it in the canon doesn't mean they might not have some truth to them. The issue, however, is if we look at the point in time when the vast majority of Gnostic documents actually originated, none of them originated in the first century A.D., and therefore none of them were written by actual apostles, even though they claim to be by people like Philip or Thomas or these other folks. Those are all pseudonyms, pen names, claims made in order to make these documents appear to be like first century documents, when in fact they aren't. Most scholars recognize that the Nag Hammadi texts, which are the bulk of the Gnostic documents, are from, at the best, the late 2nd or early 3rd century AD. For about 2 centuries, the church read this material, sifted it, and found it wanting. It wasn't excluded because somebody decided to start a conspiracy and suppress these documents and keep them secret, as if nobody knew about them except the enlightened. False. A lot of people knew about them. Irenaeus was already screaming at the end of the 2nd century AD about this these kinds of ideas. They were known for a long period of time, and what the Council of Nicaea and others after that, the Council of Constantinople, concluded was, on further review, these documents don't have any redeeming value, and therefore, let's stop copying them in our monasteries. Let's stop using them. So they weren't suppressed and as if they were originally included, then later excluded. They were never included in the first place in a canonical process.
Dr. Ben Witherington, thank you very much for giving us an hour of your time here on Issues, Etc.
No problem.
Dr. Ben Witherington is professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary. He's authored several books, including The Gospel Code, Novel Claims About Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Da Vinci. And he's also written the cover story for the latest issue of Christianity Today magazine, titled Why the Lost Gospels Lost Out. I love the idea he raised there early in the conversation about living in a Jesus-haunted culture that also suffers from an extreme form of biblical illiteracy. That probably explains as much as anything else. Not so much the subtlety of Dan Brown, but the lack of knowledge on the part of those who read, are very interested in Jesus and all sorts of the things about Jesus, but just don't know the truth, as we have it in the New Testament about our Savior Jesus Christ. Remember to tune in tonight at 8 for the rebroadcast of today's first hour of Issues, Etc. Jennifer Roback-Morse answered the question, is gay marriage neutral? We also talked with Amy White about her commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Welcoming Reagan Home. And during that first hour, rebroadcast from 8 to 9 tonight here on AM 850 KFUO, we discussed the Newsweek magazine cover story. It was a Time magazine cover story, in fact. Faith, God, and the Oval Office with David Van Bima of Time magazine. That's tonight from 8 to 9 on AM 850 KFUO. And folks, while you're at church this weekend, tell your fellow parishioners to tune in to Issues, Etc., weekdays from 3 to 6, and then, of course, as usual, on Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.